Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Shanda for the Goyim. We're going to decode this term and a few others for the Goyim. It's a perfectly normal reaction for whites to find Yiddish or Hebrew words off-putting, alienating. It's natural to interpret words like that as not for me, and to get the urge to go read or listen to something else. The author or speaker who chooses such words instead of plain English is sending a signal, expressing their Jewishness. And when you perceive Jews as the enemy, especially, the disgust and the urge to ignore any thought or argument coming from a Jewish point of view is all the more strong. Regardless of how you might perceive the Jews, what I intend to do here is make the case that the Jews see non-Jews around them as their enemies. Any form of code speak would indicate this, but the term Shanda for the Goyim really puts a point on it. So first, let's review some of the superficial explanations that we can get for this term from the Jews themselves. On a site titled Instant Yiddish, there's a definition that goes like this. Shame on you for not knowing what Shanda means. Shanda is the Yiddish word for shame, disgrace, disgusting. And not knowing what Shanda means is a double Shanda. So Shanda itself is a code word in that most Jews, most non-Jews don't know it, but it's a common concept and relatively well understood among Jews. And the scandal here, the joke that this author is making, is that it's a scandal for a Jew not to know it. I found these instant Yiddish pages using a search engine because they're buried on a site, a personal site of some Jew named Joel Aronson. And they're not linked from it, the home page or from the sitemap that you find at the top of the site. I gather from the site that this Aronson is a photographer and that he graduated from James Madison High School in Brooklyn in 1955. That's what the site is mainly about. Based on the names of his classmates, the school must have been full of Jews. The point is that Aronson doesn't come right out and advertise himself as a Jew. It's something that you have to be looking for, something that you have to see the little bits of evidence that he leaves to see it. In fact, he likely hides those Yiddish pages from sight because it's such a definitive marker of Jewishness. This knowledge and interest in Yiddish is a Jewish marker. When I was growing up in New York, I had a math teacher whose name was Aronson. And he was quirky, spastic. It never occurred to me then that it was because he was a Jew. And I wonder now how many Yiddish terms he sprinkled into his lessons or into his conversations with other teachers, constantly sending signals that I'm a Jew, which mainly only other Jews hear. I found another definition for the term buried on another website, the website of the Santa Barbara Jewish Connection, titled Jewish Phrases. Shanda, a shame, a scandal. The expression, quote, a shanda fur digoy, unquote, means to do something embarrassing to Jews where non-Jews can observe it. The subtitle of this page is The First Words You Learn. It's one of about, this term Shanda is one entry out of about 150 or so. Again, it's one of the more common bits of Jewish code that Jews know. It's not a shame or a scandal for the goyim. It's the word is F-U-R. It's a shame or scandal for the Jews in front of the goyim. Goy, of course, meaning a non-Jew, singular, and goyim being the plural, non-Jews. Jews insist that goyim means nations. Sounds harmless. But in practice, what it means is them. It means the other, non-Jews. And goyim has a distinct pejorative sense to it. The other word that they'll use sometimes is Gentile, which is synonymous, except it has a less disparaging and derogatory sense to it. But the point is that the very existence and the use by Jews of these words indicates that they see a clear distinction between themselves and others, between Jew and Goy. The classic example of the distinction is in two Yiddish phrases that are also fairly common, Yiddishkopf and Goyishkopf. Yiddishkopf means the head of a Yid, the Jewish brain. It thinks like a Jew, whereas Goyishkopf means a head like a Goy, a brain like a Goy, means stupid. Another site, Thought Catalog, which on the surface is not any more of a Jewish site than, say, the New Republic or Slate, has a page titled 61 Hilarious Yiddish Insults You Need to Know. And Shanda is 51 of 61. Again, it's a short list. The description goes, a scandal. If you have a, quote, Shanda for Digoy, unquote, that means you fuck up in front of non-Jews, thus embarrassing your entire people. This is obviously not good. It's obviously not good for the Jews. Usually the term is used only by Jews talking to other Jews. But even when it's overheard, it's easy to misunderstand. And it's misunderstood because of explanations like this one. You might take it to mean that Jews feel bad about non-Jews being harmed. But that's not really it at all. It means that they feel bad because they think it might cause Jews harm. That whatever the scandal is might be bad for the Jews. A certain ambiguity is characteristic of Yiddish. As programmers say, this is a feature, not a bug. It's a consequence of Jewish crypsis, of Jews being furtive and secretive. Even when Jews stop trying to hide their alien code words and instead try to explain the significance or the meaning of certain words or the language itself, you have to read between the lines to really understand. You have to be cynical and skeptical in what you're hearing from them to understand. A good example of this comes from the Daily Beast, a really Jewy digital tabloid, in an article titled Mazel Tov Arvind, but are you sure it's not Canadal? The article really highlights Jewish otherness. In fact, how it's expressed via Yiddish. And the author of the article absolutely revels in this otherness and expressing it. And he recounts a story of how some Indian kid won a spelling bee in the U.S. by spelling some Yiddish word, this Canadal. And the joke of the whole piece is that Yiddish is notorious for its variations in spelling. There is no set regular spelling for most words. And this Jew who's writing this article provides the usual cover story for this, the usual explanation, which is that Jews just can't agree. They have no central authority. Two Jews, three opinions, all that nonsense. And that's part of it, but it leaves out, of course, the most important facts. The fact that Yiddish has and continues to effectively serve as a code language. From a non-Jewish perspective, the many variations in spelling make it harder to search for words. What I had to do when I was researching for this podcast, for instance, was a lot more difficult than the usual podcast where you can search for a word. And if somebody can't spell the word you're looking for, you're usually not worried about those kind of references anyway. Whereas in this case, these words all have major variations. So you have to search for them. The internet makes it a lot easier than it would have been in the past, though. And that's part of why Yiddish is becoming better understood and why examples can now be found and shared with non-Jews, discussed by non-Jews. But the Jews really did this on purpose. They didn't write books about Yiddish, even though they very well could have, just as they did with every other imaginable subject. Nobody prevented them from writing books about Yiddish. And as it turns out, I did find one book that was specifically about Yiddish. The exception proves the rule. It was published in 1968 by Kensington Publishers. More about Kensington in a minute. The title of the book is Dictionary of Yiddish Slang and Idioms by Fred Kogos. I'll read a few excerpts here, highlight a few things. When Hitler killed 6 million Yiddish-speaking Jews, and when Israel proclaimed Hebrew was to be the official tongue of the nation, these actions spelled the death knell of Yiddish. I think he meant knell. Hebrew is spoken by about 2 million people in Israel and a few abroad, while Yiddish is still spoken by and known to over 10 million throughout the world. Yiddish is creeping into the English language more startlingly than is apparent, with even Webster's Third International Dictionary containing over 500 Yiddish and some Hebrew words. Kogos goes on. I'll just summarize some of his claims. He claims that his book spells out Yiddish words for the first time in Roman letters, and he implies that Yiddish previously had only been written in Hebrew characters. And this is really more evidence that Jews intended to keep this as a code language for themselves. And he claims that the beginnings of the language go back to the 11th century, and that the principal parent is Middle High German. It sounds very much like German. Many of the words are just loan words from German. With some influence from English, Hebrew, Russian, and Polish, and that there are four major dialects, Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Polish, and Western, or German. Now, the bulk of the book is omitted from Google Books online version, and that includes the entry for Shanda, so I can't relate what his dictionary has to say about that term. But about Kensington Publishers, and I got the hint because I saw that word in more than one place, Kensington, and I thought, this is odd. I wonder what the significance of this is. The original word Kensington, of course, is an area of West London. That's probably the most well-known and famous example of the word. But it's also a small, easily overlooked neighborhood in Brooklyn that has long had a vibrant Jewish community, according to brooklynjewish.org. It could also be referring to the Kensington Market, which is a neighborhood in Toronto, which became known as, quote, the Jewish Market, unquote, after waves of Jews colonized it in the early 20th century. Now, the Wikipedia page on the history of Jews in Toronto says that since the 1970s, the city has been home to the largest Jewish population in Canada and has become a center of Jewish Canadian culture. It's the largest, to put it in plain English, it's the largest colony of Jews in Canada, Toronto is, and Kensington is the epicenter, the historic core of that colony of Jews in Toronto. So the interesting thing about this Kensington concept, whether it's in Brooklyn or in Toronto, is that it's counter to the usual Jewish narrative that Jews are forced by anti-Semites to live in ghettos. Kensington is an example of Jews creating a ghetto for themselves, segregating themselves, living amongst their own. Back to Shanda for de Goyim. I found another article titled The Schmooze, some old Jewess who wrote an article titled It's a Shanda. In Yiddish, Shanda, Shande, she gives two spellings, one that ends in A and one that ends in E, means shame. And Shanda far de kinder means literally a disgrace for the children. Kinder being German for children. Arthur Naaman writes about the expression, quote, a Shanda for de Goyim, unquote. To make a Shanda for de Goyim is to do something embarrassing to Jews in a place where non-Jews can observe it. Understandably, this is looked on with much greater disfavor than to act like a jerk when only other Jews are around, since it makes things tougher on all of us. Those damn Jews, see what they're like. The old Jewess who's writing this article provides several examples. The first is Bernie Madoff, who she refers to as the Genef, another Yiddish word. I'll talk about Madoff and Genef in a bit. But he was the Wall Street scammer whose pyramid scheme collapsed in 2008. She mentions Jack Abramoff, who was convicted of mail fraud, conspiracy to bribe public officials, and tax evasion. She mentions selling organs is a shanda. More on this in a bit, too. And she mentions how some Jew wrote an article suggesting that Anthony Weiner and Eliot Spitzer, two Jewish politicians in the New York area, get out of politics. And the article was titled, The Shanda Factor, What Makes Jewish Sex Scandals Different? A little snippet of that is, for much of his career, Spitzer was a source of pride to Jews, with some supporters referring to him as having the potential to become the first Jewish president. In the blogosphere, ethnic pride, when the scandal broke, this doesn't seem to make sense, this little bit here. In the blogosphere, ethnic pride, when the scandal broke, the website Gawker proclaimed its, quote, Shanda for de Goyim, unquote. In response to, the Jewess goes on to mention another example, and that in response to a Jewish university, Brandeis, granting Tony Kushner an honorary doctorate, some outraged Jew wrote, and if you don't know who Tony Kushner is, this is all you need to know from a Jewish point of view of who he is. This outraged Jew wrote, Tony Kushner is an anti-Zionist, self-hating Schottland who never had a moral compass even in his genes, nor has he any sense of Yiddishkeit. Brandeis has committed a shande, in all caps. So a couple of Yiddish words there. I didn't look them all up, but Yiddishkeit is interesting. It means Jewishness, really. Jewish way of life. Jewish essence. It really means Yiddishness. Kite means ness in German for that modifier. And, you know, there's nothing really more Yiddishness or Jewishness than Jews moaning about some shanda or oyveying about something or another. So yes, it really does mean Jewishness. Another example of this essence of Jewishness you can find at Yiddishkeit, KAYT.org. And there it's a small group of Jews who have put up this site, but they've got a couple of messages there that explain Jewishness in terms of a few slogans. Open your borders, in all caps. Shake up your perspective. And they describe on a separate page there in their mission statement that Yiddishkeit is the culture, language, art, and worldviews of Eastern European Jews. And that's the significance of Yiddish, is that it really is, it comes from Ashkenazi Jews, Eastern European Jews primarily, as opposed to the Sephardic Jews of Western Europe, who have their own code language that they speak in. Maybe I'll talk about some other time. Another article here, and this is the last article that I'll read about it, but it's a rather lengthy one. Shanda for Di Goyim, Keeping Our Families Jewish, is the title of the e-newsletter that this comes from, this article, written by Doron Kornbluth. It was written a few years ago. He writes, as if Bernie Madoff wasn't enough, and as if Jack Abramowitz wasn't enough, and as if riots in Jerusalem weren't enough, now we have a group of very religious-looking Jews being handcuffed by the FBI in a massive fraud case that has brought down three mayors and scores of lawmakers and politicos in New Jersey. The Yiddish phrase, quote, Shanda for Di Goyim, unquote, refers to Jewish embarrassment at a fellow Jew doing something really bad in front of non-Jews. In other words, don't wash your dirty linen in public. Do we have problems? Of course. There have always been problems. But the phrase suggests be careful. The world tends to look at the Jews, and he puts quotes around the Jews, as if that's an imaginary concept. The world tends to look at the Jews as one people, and what one Jew does reflects well or badly on us, on the rest of us. According to this idea, doing something bad is bad enough, but it becomes much worse when it reflects badly on the entire Jewish people. How do you feel about this phrase? Does it still apply? Does the world still, quote, lump us together, unquote? I'll leave it to you to decide. In a sense, though, today the discussion may be academic. With modern technology, word gets out. Even if we wanted to wash our dirty linen in private within the Jewish community, it isn't really possible anymore anyway. The events mentioned above were on the news again and again and again. Specifically, the visuals of religious-looking Jews being violent or in custody are hard to avoid or forget. And that's exactly why these kind of articles get written, is because they can no longer avoid the subject. The secret is getting out. And so the next line of defense is to create a narrative explaining, mis-explaining, what it all means. I'll note here the inversion that this Jew comes up with, that it's really the Jews who see themselves and act as one people more than anyone else. And when Jews fret about a Shanda for Di Goyim, what they're really worried about is that the Goyim might catch on to their game and also see them as a group, and maybe even punish them as a group or organize their own groups. Again, he mentions Madoff. Madoff looms very large in any discussion of Shanda for Di Goyim. And he mentions Abramowitz. I don't know if he did that tongue in cheek, but he's talking about Abramoff, Jack Abramoff, another one who looms large in these kind of discussions. He also refers, and what he's mainly talking about, the latest Shanda for Di Goyim, is the bid rig scandal, which occurred back in 2009 when the FBI arrested a whole ring of Orthodox Jews in the New York City, New Jersey area for bribing politicians. A bunch of other things, including organ trafficking, which was the tip of an iceberg, really. And that Jewess I mentioned, her article and the things that she gave as examples of Shanda, she also mentioned organ donations. And it's not really about organ donations so much as it's about stealing organs. And there's a two-fold Shanda here, a really lame and weak one, which is basically the embarrassment of Jews that the Orthodox don't donate they certainly are willing to receive organs, but they don't want to donate them. But that's not the worst of it. And I did some previous podcasts about Jews and organ transplants, a three-part series, and it was in part three where I really focused on what this whole organ transplant thing had, what it was about, and how Shanda for de Goyim figured into it. I wrote, Shanda for de Goyim is misunderstood as embarrassment. It is actually a reflection of Jewish sensitivity to collective exposure, responsibility, and vulnerability. It's an alarm, a call for the making of excuses and the transferring of blame elsewhere. The most extreme and common example is how Jews transfer blame to, quote, anti-Semitism, unquote, as they often do for the organ trafficking and organ stealing that they're involved in. And what's going on isn't simply organ trafficking, because there's extortion of organs from people who have been misled and who are desperate. They really are victims who are forced into selling their organs for a pittance, and then those organs get resold at an enormous profit. And it's all very, very Jewy. There's Jew patients, Jew doctors, Jew brokers, and it all goes on, even though it's illegal, worldwide, because there are so many Jews involved, because the Jews won't rout out each other, and because nobody else will dare prosecute them most of the time, even when they're caught red-handed. And the cherry on top of it all is that there's more Jews that are pushing to legalize the harvesting and selling of organs for profit. Now, about Bernie Madoff and this Ganef word. Ganef means thief or swindler or crook, an unscrupulous opportunist who stoops to sharp practice. But what it really means is specifically a Jewish thief or one who steals from the Jews. Like all Yiddish terms, there's an implied Jewishness to anything that the word is used to describe. It's, in this case, Ganef means a thief from a Jewish point of view, because otherwise the person would just say thief if it had nothing to do with the Jews. One example of this word being used I found in an article titled A Short Post About Jesse Jackson Jr. in the Daily Beast, written by Michael Tomosky. Now, Michael Tomosky is one of these ambiguous Jews. He gives off all sorts of signals that he's a Jew just by the subjects that he writes about and the way that he writes about them. But he never comes right out and says, as a Jew, I think this or that. He's never explicit about it. But this pretty much marks him as a Jew. He writes, I'm going to write this just so our conservative friends can't say that I brush these things under the rug. And he's talking about Jesse Jackson Jr. and some scandal that he got involved in back in 2013. He's clearly a troubled man, he writes, but he's also a Ganef and a loser. So good riddance to him, all right? And there's more to the article, but it's a relatively short article. And that's a good example there, the use of the word Ganef there. Who's going to know what that word means but other Jews? Non-Jews will probably read that, and most will probably skim right over it, not even miss the word, because they don't know it. And you're just that way when you're reading and you see a word that you don't know, you'll as often skip over it as stop and look it up. But even if you look it up, you look it up and you find out, oh, it means thief. And most people wouldn't occur to them that what he's doing here is he's signaling to his conservative friends, meaning Jews on the other side of the political spectrum, that he's going to address this subject. And he does it in a very Jewish way, using this word Ganef. And like most other Yiddish words, there's multiple spellings for it. G-A-N-E-F, G-O-N-E-F, G-O-N-I-F. It's a mess if you're trying to search for examples of uses of these words. Now, about Bernie Madoff. Madoff, the thing that's significant about Madoff is that back in 2008, at the end of 2008, when his scandal, his Schande vor den Goyim erupted, is that Madoff had for decades been a Wall Street insider, an insider's insider, really. A past chairman of the board of directors of NASDAQ, a member of the board of governors of the National Association of Securities Dealers. I mean, it doesn't get more insider than Bernie Madoff. And yet, oh, and he had been a money manager since 1960, so an old, established Jew. And his money fund that he ran was known informally as the Jewish Bond. And it was known as the Jewish Bond because it was very exclusive, invite only, and the payoff was unbelievably high. And so Jews called it the Jewish Bond because so many Jews were involved in it, and they thought that they were ripping somebody off. They thought that Bernie was doing something illegitimate, but they just thought it was somebody else was getting ripped off, and it was insider knowledge or something that Madoff was cheating someone else. And it turned out that the Jews involved weren't the ones being cheated in the end anyway, although they were the ones who squawked most loudly about it in the end. But what the whole affair really brought to light is just how much money there is sloshing around in what's called Jewish philanthropy, and how much of this quote-unquote philanthropy actually goes to exclusively Jewish causes. The collapse of the pyramid, again, it wasn't brought on by outsiders. Despite many complaints over the years from other people saying that they suspected him of fraud, nobody dared to touch him. It wasn't until the bubble burst in 2007, 2008 that caused people to need cash, and so some of his clients were demanding their funds. And when they withdrew too many people withdrew too much at one time, his pyramid became impossible to continue anymore. And that at that point, it seems like what he did was he tried to take the fall himself. And so he went with the story that he was the only one who really knew what was going on. His family didn't know. It was pretty obviously in an attempt to try and protect his family and protect his friends, because this was really, the Jewish Bond was owned and operated, and the most profit was made by his friends and family who were in at the ground floor of the whole pyramid scheme when it started, and took the most money out of it. The Jewish cover story for the Bernie Madoff Schande vor den Goyim was formed within a week of the scandal breaking. And that story is still the story that you can find in Wikipedia. The story goes like this, that most of Madoff's victims were charitable organizations, elderly people, and Jews. And this comes from a story that was literally written a week after the story broke and before all of the details were really known. And what came out afterward, and it's worth a whole podcast probably just dedicated to the whole summarizing what happened with Bernie Madoff. But in a nutshell, the early participants of the pyramid were Jews, and the later participants, the one that supplied the bulk of the money in the end, and the ones who lost the most money, were non-Jewish corporations and city governments, municipalities, and feeder funds, aggregators that took funds from lots of different people who had no idea where it was going. And based on the high reputation of this Jewish Bond that Madoff had been running, invested with him. And those are the people who really got ripped off in the end. Now, there are lots of other examples of Schandes vor den Goyim. Dominique Strauss-Kahn comes to mind, Jonathan Pollard and other Jewish spies, Greville Janner in Britain, Jeffrey Epstein and Alan Dershowitz. In fact, there was an article I came across that in a comment, and it's often you see a reference to Schande vor den Goyim in comments, because they don't write whole articles about it, really. But someone wrote in an article about Alan Dershowitz and his involvement in this Epstein thing that if this isn't an example of Shanda for de Goyim, I don't know what is. Well, I know one thing that is. Today is the 9th of June, broadcast day for this podcast. The 8th of June is the anniversary of the USS Liberty attack, the attack that the Israeli military made on a U.S. Intelligence gathering ship off its coast back in 1967. And funny enough, not funny really, tragic, there is no association of the term Shanda for de Goyim with the USS Liberty and what happened to the Liberty, the attack on the Liberty. And I think that reflects the fact that it's not really not a scandal, but that the Jews took a completely different approach with the Liberty. That they just tried to bury. They never worried so much about what that meant for the Jews because they were able to just bury the whole thing. And it was actually a far larger scandal than any of these other individual crimes committed by individual Jews. It seems somehow that Shanda for de Goyim really only gets rolled out by Jews, only attached to individual scandals that might grow into something larger and more collective of a problem for Jews. So let me wrap up here by noting a few things. The use of Yiddish by Jews is a clear expression not only of their otherness, but of their consciousness of that otherness. It indicates also the asymmetry of this consciousness, that non-Jews generally aren't aware not only of the meaning of the individual words and phrases that they're hearing or reading or not hearing, but they're missing the larger picture that the Jews' use of Yiddish is as a code to signal and communicate specifically Jewish concerns to other Jews. In a quote-unquote liberal society where we're all supposed to be one big us, the mere existence of the term Shanda for de Goyim is evidence of bad faith. It's evidence that the worldview of Jews is actually in terms of us Jews versus them Goyim, that they're fully conscious of this, and that it would be bad for the Jews if the Goyim knew and acted on such a worldview as well. There is no simple equivalent for the term in English. It's difficult to translate because Jewish attitudes are so different. Basically, it's yet another example of Jews expressing their utmost concern for their own group. In this case, the main concern is exposure. Exposure of harm caused by Jews. Evidence of Jewish parasitism is how I would put it, especially their manipulation or exploitation of non-Jews. The main desire of Jews is not to stop the harm or even to punish the Jew who's most responsible, but instead to somehow stop the exposure, to stop any harm from coming to Jews. That's what Shanda for de Goyim means. It means transfer the blame elsewhere. It means bury it. It means shut it down.